Welcome to the Not Old Better Show. I'm your host, Paul Vogelsang. As part of our Smithsonian Associates Art of Living series, my guest today, Dr. Susan Persky, is an associate investigator at the Social and Behavioral Research Branch, National Human Genome Research Institute, at the National Institutes of Health. Dr. Persky, as you can certainly surmise from her title, is a busy person, and we're fortunate to be joined by her here on the Not Old Better Show. Among her responsibilities are to provide scientific oversight into the fascinating area of immersive virtual environment testing, virtual reality in medicine, and virtual environments.
Virtual reality is generally thought of as a computer technology that creates an environment digitally that surrounds a user and can provide an experience to the user where they really feel present within that virtual or that digital environment.
That, of course, was our guest today, Dr. Susan Persky, who's appearing at the Smithsonian Associates program, How Virtual Reality is Changing Medicine, August 17th, 2017, at the Ripley Center in Washington, D.C. Join me in welcoming today to the Not Old Better Show, Dr. Susan Persky. Well, Dr. Susan Persky, thanks so much for joining us today on the Not Old Better Show.
It's great to be here.
We're going to talk a little bit about virtual reality because you're going to be talking about virtual reality at an upcoming presentation at Smithsonian Associates August 17th at the Ripley Center. When I think virtual reality, and maybe some of my audience and maybe many people, they might think gaming. They might even consider virtual reality to be kind of straight out of science fiction. Does virtual reality get kind of a bad rap?
I don't know if it gets a bad rap, but I would say that right now most people probably do equate it with gaming. Consumer VR is brand new, but VR has been around for really quite a long time. In the research world, we've been thinking about and using VR probably for about 30 years. And there's a lot of really important and wonderful things that one can do with VR that lie completely outside of gaming or, you know, only bring in some elements of gaming. And so I think as time goes on and VR starts to be used more by the public and reaches into more arenas, people are going to start to see some of the really exciting and great things that VR can do.
Define for us VR, and particularly this area of virtual immersive therapy that you and your team work on. Define that a little bit for us.
So virtual immersive therapy, basically VR has been used in psychotherapy and in mental health for quite a while now. Early on, some researchers figured out that, you know, when you do immersion therapy to get people desensitized to certain kinds of environments or things maybe that they're phobic of, or maybe if somebody has post-traumatic stress disorder, you want them to imagine the things that are causing them distress to help them, you know, ratchet that level of distress down. Imagining things is difficult. Sometimes if a phobia, you know, if you have a fear of flying, let's say, it's a little difficult for the therapist to kind of, you know, go with you and help you deal with that fear. But if you create those environments in virtual reality, it actually translates to real-world outcomes. So now a therapist can, you know, bring somebody into their office. They can sit them down and put them in a virtual reality airport, talk to them as they travel through the airport, get on the plane, experience a virtual plane takeoff. And they start to feel a lot of those feelings. I mean, it tricks the brain to some extent into thinking these things are real. In some important ways, and the therapist can be right there with them throughout that experience without having to actually go to the airport and get on an airplane and so on. And so, that's been a really exciting development that people have been working on.
I think one of the interesting things about you and your work and your history is that you're working almost in the middle between patient and provider. Are you finding that with regard to VR, you're having to both introduce the patient and the provider to this subject and kind of bring them together around what it might accomplish?
So I tend to work with patient and with provider somewhat separately. providers in provider training are actually fairly used to simulation. Many med schools have sim centers where, you know, medical students or other clinical trainees interact with often actors, but also mannequins and other kinds of simulations. So this isn't so new, you know, on the provider side, but doing it in virtual reality is a little bit new. So we sort of introduced this as just another type of simulation one might do. On the patient side, though, it is pretty much a new thing to sort of sit someone down and say, well, you'll be seeing, you know, in my case, my virtual doctor is called Dr. Morrison, so you'll be talking with Dr. Morrison, you know, and he's going to give you some information. You know, everything I do is research-based, so we don't do any actual virtual reality clinical visits. We're studying the patient-provider interaction, but for all of our, you know, research participants who are playing the role of the patient as they do in real life, you know, this is quite a new thing.
You brought up psychiatric care as being one of the kind of foremost or early on therapeutic uses of VR. What about suicide? Is there an application here? It's not so much the kind of the original kind of cost-based model, but it might show maybe someone a different path, or it might give them ideas about how to conduct themselves in a more positive way or lead them to certain actions. Is that part of some of the research that you're doing at NIH too?
So it's not part of my research, and suicide isn't part of what I think people have traditionally used VR for in mental health, but there are, you know, now that VR is becoming much more widespread and a consumer technology, there are really creative people out there that are thinking of new venues for applying VR tools, and I know suicide is one of them, and, you know, there are a lot of ways that that can be done. There are also a lot of people doing, for example, perspective taking exercises. VR is a great, great tool for perspective taking.
Describe that.
Sure. Yeah. So the idea is that you would, basically put somebody in the shoes of somebody else. Mm. You know, one of the earlier ones was, regarding schizophrenia. So, you know, people with schizophrenia may hear voices that aren't there. They may see things that aren't there. And there's a lot of stigma involved with that, but, you know, until you really understand what someone might experience, you can't really understand it. And so the idea would be that, if we could create a virtual world where we could simulate some of the things that someone suffering from a condition might experience, and let people who don't have experience with that condition know what it's like. So that's been something very powerful, and not just in illness. I know that there have been some 360 video projects around refugees. There have been some projects around even experiencing what you might be like, you know, as you're older. You know, if you may be moving slower or, you know, experiencing the world in different ways. You know, there are all sorts of ways to put people in a situation where they're kind of experiencing the world through the perspective of somebody else.
We talked to Dr. Eric Green from NIH about genomics not too long ago. I know your work overlaps some of the genomics, in particular in the areas of social sciences. Tell us how social sciences and genomics interface with each other. It seems like, it might be a difficult interaction, but it seems also that there might be a real sameness there.
Yeah, I mean, there is a real synergy with genomics in the social sciences, and actually, social and behavioral sciences are really baked in to genomic research, and even as early as the Human Genome Project. The idea being that there are all kinds of social, ethical, legal issues that are bound up in learning about our genetics and learning about our genes and even sequencing the human genome and, you know, sort of what does it mean to be human? What does it mean that my genes are different than somebody else's genes? What does it mean that, you know, type 2 diabetes and obesity have a lot of genetic origin? You know, what do these things mean to people? And so it's a really natural fit for social science. I'm working in the social and behavioral research branch, which is a part of the National Human Genome Research Institute, which Eric Green is a head of. And so I think over the long term, the leadership in genomics has really understood the need for social and behavioral research to be a part of genomics.
That's all really interesting to me. It also seems to almost border a little bit of the work that many of my audience do in terms of their genealogy. And it seems like the more we know about our ancestry, the more we might be able to understand our family health history. That's all part of this too, would you say?
Oh, absolutely. That's something that my colleagues and I think about and study a lot. Because family history is part genetics, it's part the family environment. It's has everything all bound up in it, and it really is very important to understand one's family history for, you know, different conditions to even understand how to approach staying healthy and preventing disease. A screening regimen, for example, for diabetes might differ depending on your family history. So how families should talk about, you know, disease running in families and what kind of communication should go on in the family and the types of risks that are associated with having a family history of disease is something that we study as social and behavioral scientists quite a lot.
We're with Dr. Susan Persky, who's the director of immersive virtual environment testing at the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland. Dr. Persky is going to be at the Ripley Center August 17th at 6:45. She's going to be talking about how virtual reality is changing medicine. This is just a fascinating subject, Dr. Persky. I know you're really busy. We're looking forward to seeing you on the 17th. I just really have one final question, and that is, tell us what you and your team are most proud of and feel maybe is the most rewarding of your work with immersive virtual testing.
That's a great question. So I think what's most rewarding for me is thinking about how people really feel when they interface with genetics and genomics and when they interface with the medical system. So a lot of my work really revolves around human experience. So some of my work deals with what parents think when they receive genomic-based health information or risk information for their children. How does it make them feel emotionally? Do they feel guilty? If they feel guilty, you know, how do we alleviate that guilt? But also help them to improve the health behaviors that can make their kids more healthy. When people go to the doctor and the doctor talks about genomic information, you know, might it make them feel like the doctor's not blaming them as much for having the condition they're there to see the doctor about? So in my eyes, studying genomics and using virtual reality to simulate some of these situations really helps me to make people feel less blamed and less stigmatized and feel better about themselves and help them learn how to stay healthier. So in social and behavioral science, there are a lot of different ways to test our research questions, but often we end up bringing people into the lab and having sort of a artificial context or just sort of asking them what their intentions would be, you know, to improve behavior or to change behavior. And what's been so rewarding about using virtual reality is that I can measure people's actual behavior, you know, right after we give them educational materials or intervention materials. And that is a lot more relevant to what they're going to do when they leave the lab and they go back out into the real world. So being able to bring those sorts of scenarios into the lab and use them as outcome measures is really a great thing.
What a pleasure it's been to talk to you, Dr. Persky, and learn a little bit about this cutting-edge science and technology, this emerging area of medicine. Again, Dr. Susan Persky has been with us today. Dr. Persky will be at the Smithsonian Associates Program Thursday, August 17th at the Ripley Center. Dr. Persky, I'm going to be there. I think this is really interesting stuff. Thanks for joining us today.
Fantastic. I look forward to it.
Thanks so much to our guest today, Dr. Susan Persky, as well as the National Institutes of Health and Smithsonian Associates for all the help on the podcast. And as usual, we'll post links to everything. And also, as usual, my thanks to you, the listeners, for joining me today. Your time is valuable. I'm grateful you're spending some of it with me today. I'm always interested in feedback, and you can leave that at iTunes, Google Play, send me an email at info@notoldbetter.com. You can find me on all of the social media sites, so please give me some feedback. Let me know how we're doing. I think we're doing some great stuff. It's Talk About Better, the Not Old Better Show. Thanks to all.